Bob Summers, Reel 5. So you were just telling us at the end of Reel 4 how the Russians had been shipped off from...
Yeah.
Where was it they were shipped
out? They were in a camp at Beverley, and we took them across to Liverpool and put them on the ship and waved them fond farewell. I say, and unfortunately, I believe most of them went back. And, of course, the reason why the cartload of Russians didn't want to go back and were a bit manhandled by the military police was that they knew their destination and outcome, probably.
Which was? Do you know where they were going?
Oh, well, it was back to Russia and bang, bang.
How had they ended up in Britain in the first place?
Well, they were captured fighting for the Germans in France.
Oh, right, yeah. So
they probably had no option other than fighting for the Germans. They would probably come and fight for us or bang, bang, where they were.
So I wonder why the British didn't keep them in a prisoner of war camp.
Because they were trying to be very pally with the Russians. The Russians wanted them back. And, of course, there was this business in Austria where we sent back all the Cossacks. It was because what the Russians said, we did.
Yes, yeah, right.
I presume.
Yeah. So you used to work that out at the time? You were aware?
At the time, no. We just thought, well, they've been fighting against us, you know, hard luck. But it's on retrospect that you only sort of see the correct thing, probably.
What date would that have been?
After D-Day, you see.
Right.
Okay. Oh, it would have to be... Oh, Lord, no, that wouldn't... Yes, it was after D-Day. It would be about January.
Mm.
January 45.
45?
Yes.
How late is that?
Yes. It's after they've been... See, they've been captured in Europe.
Yes.
After D-Day, and they've been brought back there.
Mm. Right, okay. You don't know what the name of the ship was they went
to? No, I haven't a clue, no.
Okay, fair enough, right. So, you were getting back to after you'd been through Europe, you came back to Britain.
Yeah.
You went to Liverpool, was it? No, sorry, Scotland, was it? You set off for the east.
Far east, Liverpool.
Liverpool again, right.
Yes, okay. Thereby hangs a tale.
Yes. Do you know the name of the ship you went on?
Yes, the Durban Castle.
Right, okay.
But we got on this train at Longmoor, reinforcements, it was all officers, and we stopped at a station in London and picked up about 40 ATS girls who were on the same trip, and on the train... We smuggled aboard a lady who just married one of the officers, and they hadn't had a honeymoon.
Mm.
So we made sure they got a compartment, and we stood a guard on the outside of the corridor, and they had their honeymoon on the train. these things, and then we got on and went all our way. And next thing, we finished up as in Rangoon.
Yeah. When you left Liverpool, was it daylight? Or?
In daylight, foggy and misty, yeah. Canada Dock, I remember, it's Canada Dock.
Did you see, were there people waving you off? And
oh, Lord, no. No, the only thing that stands out a mile, this Canada Dock is sort of, you have to go through another dock, through a lock gate, to get out into the Mersey. And just as we were going through the last lock gate, I don't know how they did it, but a couple of chaps jumped off the boat.
Really?
Yes. And but they were soon picked up, and before the ship had got out of the Mersey, a launch came alongside and put them back on again.
And they were officers, were they?
No,
How many people were there on the ship?
Oh, haven't a clue, I suppose. 600 or 800 men.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We were compared with coming home, it was a very elegant way out. I mean, I shared a cabin with somebody, the Durban Castle. It was one of the pre-war top ships, and it hadn't been militarised very much, and it was very pleasant, actually.
Right. So you didn't know at that stage where you were going?
No, not until we got halfway across there.
Mm. So what was the trip like?
Oh, very nice. Of course, in those days, there was no air conditioning on ships, or very little. There certainly wasn't down in the holds. And the men were on hammocks in the holds. It was pretty revolting, really. I mean, they were there like hanging in rows like bats. When the ship swung, they all swung. And, of course, it got blinking hot. And, of course, at night, everybody... When we were going through the Red Sea, which was September, it was pretty hot. And as in my father's day, when he did a similar thing, we had a man die on the ship and the ship stopped and we had a ship's funeral.
Really?
Yes.
Buried at sea?
It's buried at sea, yes.
What was that like?
Well, it was...
Experience?
Well, the ship... You suddenly, of course, the... Nobody knows anything about it. Suddenly the ship stopped, and you wonder why the ship stopped. And the word got around and looked out, and they was holding a little service on the ship's side, and the poor old body was on a plank, you know, and then just plop.
Mm-hmm.
And but there we are, bad luck for somebody.
Yeah. So it took a while, this journey?
Yes, it took about 3 weeks. And
Where did you see along the way?
Well, we went obviously Gibraltar. We passed at night. Long in the daytime, you could see the north coast of Africa from time to time, and then through the Red Sea, which the Suez Canal, which in the Red Sea, which was quite interesting. Of course, you've got to remember, none of us had ever been abroad before this date. I mean, we're the most ever you've been to a seaside in England was about the best you ever went. And to see this world, you know, at the king's expense, you know, was quite amazing, really. You didn't think of it in those terms, but it must have been, yes.
I mean, you'd heard a lot about the Japanese fighting,
yes,
hadn't you?
Yeah.
Although that had finished. I mean, were you apprehensive at going out?
No, not at all. Something else to do, you know, a bit of adventure, really. And we the ship anchored in Rangoon River, and we got climbed down the side of the ship into landing craft, and nothing, of course, it was purely nothing wrong there, and just went up river and landed in on the hard at Rangoon, and then up to a transit camp just outside Rangoon, about 8 miles, at a place called Insane, where this chap who's just been let out of prison was in prison, and the first thing I did within 24 hours of landing there was having a fantastic internal stomach trouble, and I don't know what happened for the next couple of days, really. But we were lying out in tents, you know. And my first contact with the murky Far East was putting my foot down off one of this bed, charpoy, as we used to call, down in the... just missed a scorpion, which was about 6 inches long and looking rather horrible, but that was only a detail.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, were you told by this time what you were going to do?
No. Then names called out one day, there's a vehicle waiting for you. Jumped in, away we go, and I found myself with the Indian Army unit.
Right, whereabouts?
Just outside Rangoon at that time.
Do you know which Indian Army unit it was?
Well, it was the... Being an engineer, this was the Indian Army mechanical equipment. So I got involved with bulldozers and the like and things like that. And
so what was it like?
And then I got put in charge of, again, an Indian unit, and I had about 40 Indians, and I couldn't speak the language. Could normally reinforcements arrive via India, and they had 6 months to learn the language. But I got thrown in again at the deep end, and fortunately, I'd got a clerk who could speak English, and an Indian Army clerk who could speak English. So we eventually found our way, you know, and got things done.
So what was life like then with the Indian Army as opposed to the British Army?
Oh, completely different altogether. And also again, once again, we were completely isolated. I never saw anything like a regiment or any military organisation for the next 2 years. In the end, we became a private army, and just, you know, in fact, we didn't see any superior rank for 12 months. Mind you, at that time, towards the end of the second year, first year, the Indian Army was being to be disbanded. And I spent the last 3 months of my life out there going up a 360-mile ride right up country to towards Mandalay, picking up army, Indian Army units, and bringing them back down into or another 360 miles down to Rangoon and putting them on a ship, sending them back to India, and then turning around and doing the same thing again.
Right. So these Indian Army units have been fighting, have they?
Oh, yes, and yes, yes, yes. Yeah. I mean, the thing that amazes me, again in retrospect, is how unappreciative the British are of what the Indians have done for this country. Do you know, 2/3 of all the casualties in the Burma campaign were Indians. And it was pretty horrible for the English blokes, and they did jolly well, but it was also very bad for the Indians, and they were volunteers. I mean, they didn't have to join the Indian Army, yeah. But they did. Yeah. And I say 2/3 of all the casualties were Indians. But they were very nice.
When you got to this, your unit there,
yeah.
You stayed there.
Yeah.
So what sort of a camp was it? Was it a barracks? Or
no, Lord, no. What they call bashes, you know, made of bamboo. Well, you've seen this ain't half hot mum on the thing. Well, you could, except they were not English. It was just like that. Absolutely. In fact, when I see that, I get quite a smile because it's so true. It was so true to life. Except that, of course, we weren't an entertainment part. We were doing a bit of a job.
So you had the punkawaller.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah.
So what sort of establishment was it? I mean, how many people?
Well, I say I got about 40 Indians, and they were bulldozer drivers, digger drivers, plant operators, and they were very good. They did, and we used to have a few odd jobs to go and do. We weren't overworked.
Yeah.
It was, of course, after the war, and it was just a case of keeping the wheels turning.
Yeah. So what sort of odd jobs were you doing?
Well, you know, we'd straighten up a road and all that sort of thing, clear a bit of jungle or do something. But I can't remember working very hard.
Were you the only white man?
In that lot, yes.
Yes.
But we were part of a larger company, which I did see more of, because socially, you had. I was on my own, so when I had any time off at all at the weekend, we had a company. We operated as a unit, a subunit of a company,
right.
And. I used to go back and we used to sort of get together and...
Mm. Where was that company?
That was, again, in the same area, in Rangoon. Yeah,
uh-huh.
Rangoon.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was Rangoon like then?
Well, all run down, of course, very run down. But it's like an Indian city, really, completely run down. People sleeping on the pavement at night, you know. But the Burmese are a race apart. They're a very... very fine race, which most of us don't really, people don't understand them. They're as good a race as Burmese, as we are in this country. People sort of look down on them as first-class Indians, something they're not. They're a different race altogether. And very superior, very intelligent. Well, of course, they've got their own pre-war. They had their own university and things like that. But half the population is Indian or very low, that's low caste. No, it's the caste, they're a bit difficult in an Indian context, but the lower sort of types of Indians of people. And better people, the better class people, were the Burmese.
Right. Did you learn or pick up about Burmese culture?
Well, I was interested, yes. Mm. Yes. You picked up a bit naturally, you know.
Did you have much contact with Burmese?
Oh, yes. Yes, because latterly I joined another company. In the Indian Army, doing the same thing in a different sort of way, and we had a pre-war bungalow on the outskirts of Rangoon, near the Shwedagon Pagoda, where you see in all the photographs, and it was pretty run down. There weren't any windows in it or anything like that, but it didn't really matter because it's warm anyway.
Yeah.
and we lived there, and adjacent to us was a little Burmese cafe restaurant with a rather shady bloke running it, And we used to slip him the odd bottle of scotch, and we used to be able to go across there and have contact with the, with the Burmese. In matter of fact, I can remember sleeping there one night, so we must have had some contact with them.
Yeah. So, I mean,
but not a lot, really.
Yeah. I mean, was there alcohol about, or was it just what the military...
Well, we used to get very little. Mm. But it got to increase gradually, and we were a mixed unit, which is a bit unusual in the Indian Army, and so we were both Hindus and Muslims, which is very unusual. They were usually either one or the other.
Mm. Was that because they had specialist training?
That's right. So. I should imagine so, yes. Mm. And things that stand out in my mind are two things, which, well, nothing to do with work at all, but just the social side of it, was that the Subedar was the equivalent of the regimental sergeant major, was a Pathan, and he was quite a gent in his own right. Well, his predecessor that I'm talking about. And for some or other, he'd upset some of the troops. And at night, when it came dusk, everybody lived in tents, the soldiery anyway. They used to go around with a spray of anti-mosquito stuff and spray the inside of the tents. And inside the tents, there was one electric light bulb, because we were a permanent setup, you see. Well, on this particular chappie's day, they went and sprayed with petrol. And this had happened before I arrived, just before I'd arrived. And when he went to turn on his electric light, whoop, he went up in flames, and he was burnt up with it.
Really?
And there was an army inquiry was still going on about that. That was the one thing that intrigued me.
Do you think, could someone have substituted petrol for
that? Oh, yes, absolutely. It always a guarantee. Yes.
Goodness, and he was burnt up with
the
tent.
Yes. Oh, all sorts of funny things happen like that. I've just thought of something else which got out of my mind.
Did you have to take account of different religions in your study?
Oh, yes, you had to be very careful. Mm. I gradually picked up a bit of the Urdu language, but again, I had a very good Indian clerk who was a Christian. Mm. And shouldn't say this, but the only people you would be wary about when it comes to honesty is Indian Christians. Well, you see, it depends on the religion.
Mm.
You see, the Muslims can only do certain things, mm. the Hindus can only do certain things, but with a Christian, it's left to his own integrity.
Mm.
And of course, some of them haven't got much integrity.
Different interpretations. Yeah. So you were there, based in one place, doing...
No, I was around there, but I was a place called Mactilla, which is just south of Mandalay, mm-hmm. for a month or so.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I was in around Rangoon area. Yeah.
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 So, did you feel you were serving your country, or did you want to go home?
Well, we wanted to go home. We were forgotten army. They were a forgotten army during the war, and certainly after the war, especially when you were in the Indian Army, you were completely forgotten. Nobody, in fact. At the end of the war, I'd finished up in Singapore for a short while before I came home. And I went to the army records about some problem which had set up in Singapore, and they didn't even know I existed.
Mm.
At some stage in the war, if I could have found my way home, I could have gone home and nobody would have been any the wiser.
So you met other British officers.
Oh, yes, so, yes. Yeah. They were all British officers.
Mm.
Well, in our little unit... I'm going to tell you the next story. But in this little unit that I was in, this company, it's ME Company, Mechanical Equipment Company, there were four British officers, one Indian officer, mm-hmm. and a warrant officer who was an Indian, Anglo-Indian, and worked for Indian Railways pre-war. And he was the biggest rogue that ever was. And he ran our little mess, and whatever it costs, you divided the costs between them, wasn't it? And that was that. And when he when he got demobbed and left the company to go, before he went, he said to me, because I was going to take over running of this little mess, he said, I'll put you onto something here. He said, this company was a pretty big company, all told. Must have been 300 or 400 in each. He said, I'm drawing beer for all this number. But he said, of course, as you know, only about a third of them drink. So every year, month, I've got a surplus of about X number of bottles. He said, and I'm selling them to the Burma police. And he said, and they take them up country and sell them to the Chinese on the Chinese border. And he said, I sell them for $1 a bottle. He said, God knows what they cost at the top. He said, but it's a nice little earner. So, he was the world's worst, this man was. And, I believe if you worked for India Railways pre-war, you were known for that.
So what was it? This was the officer's mess in Rangoon.
Yes, well, a little house, but it's a little house.
Because there must have been quite a lot of British officers there.
Yes, the only place we ever used to meet, there was an officer's club down in Rangoon.
Right.
Which was rather nice, really.
What sort of building was that?
Well, that was one of the pre-war, palatial sort of establishment had been run over. It wasn't much bigger than a house. It was quite, I don't know, God knows what it was. Mm. Could have been a restaurant or something, you know. Mm. But that's where everybody used to meet on a Saturday night.
What sort of evenings would those be?
Oh, you could have quite a good meal, you know, Indian style. Mm-hmm. And they started getting wine in from South Africa, so we were, always very sociable.
Yeah. Did you have WBS people
there? Yes, and nurses and things, yeah. I suppose. Made up the numbers.
Yes.
Talking about the ATS, though, it's rather funny, you know, going out on this troop ship. All the soldiery were trying to sort of make their mark with the ATS girls, and the ATS girls didn't want to know you, see. So that was that. Well, coming back on the troop ship that we came back on, it was quite the difference, you see, because all the blokes were going back to their wives and sweethearts, and the girls that hadn't got sort of caught on were left high and dry, so it was quite the reverse, you know. It was really rather funny.
So Rangoon was sort of home then, you know,
yes.
How long were you there altogether?
Ooh, nearly 2 years.
Mm.
I spent the last 2 years all the about 4 months, which I went. I was posted to, of course, the Indian Army was running down by then, and I was the only bloke left in that part of the world that knew anything about mechanical equipment, bulldozers and the like. You see, so. I was posted down to Singapore to become Staff Officer 3, which was an upgrading of a rank, to run after to do that job, cope with on the staff job, you see. So I got on an old Dakota at Mingledon Aerodrome, which is Rangoon Aerodrome now, and it was only two planes left out of a squadron. And they'd all been cannibalised to keep the others going, and I was on the last two, so you can imagine it was tied up with bits of wire, I think. Anyway, had a ride down to sitting on mailbags down past Rangoon, Penang, Singapore. When I eventually, a long story, but the thing that amused me more was that when I got to Singapore, I went for an interview for this staff job with some bloke had been in the army pre-war, and I shouldn't think he'd ever realised that the war had ever existed. I mean, there's a different atmosphere, colonial atmosphere out there, even then after the war, you know. And he asked me various questions, and one of the questions they asked was, do you play polo? I couldn't believe my ears. I said, not bloody likely, I loathe horses, that didn't do me any good. Then he said, the next thing he said, are you prepared to put off your DMOB by 6 months? And I said, not thinking likely. So he said, well, I don't know what to do with you. He said, I know. He said, there's a regular officer on an English ME unit who's going on what they called LIAP, which was the special leave they had just after the war. He said, you can go and take his unit over while he's away, and that'll just fill in time with you to be DMOBbed. So that suited me. When I got there...
Where was that?
This was again in Singapore. In Singapore, mm-hmm. Just on the out. I believe now it's all built over, but it was out in the country in those days. And this chap said to me, "Well, I don't really want to go on leave. He said, I'm going to get married to a Dutch girl, nurse, who's in the day, and she isn't free to go for another 6 months. I said, so every time this application comes in, I mess it up, so I don't go. So I'm playing for time. So I still went and joined him. So my last 3 or 4 months in the army, it was the leave I'd never had before, really, because I didn't do very much. We got a sailing, we used to sail around, start our holidays, weekend on a Wednesday, you know, and sail through to the following Tuesday night. With marvellous experience, really, because we put a sailing boat together and we used to sail around what was the Dutch East Indies and all these lovely little islands, only down as far as Bali and places. Oh, it was fabulous, really.
So what was Singapore like? I mean, you'd heard...
Oh, Singapore... Oh, well, of course, there was one tall building called the Cathay Building, and that was about 6 stories high. There was none of the... Now, I believe, it's like Hong Kong, isn't it? It was... In part, I believe, there's still what they call Old Chinatown in Singapore. Well, it was all like that. Except, on the front, there was a rather palatial building, which was the government building, and there was a square, shopping square with some rather nice shops in, but apart from those two places it was just old Chinatown.
Mm. Did you see evidence of the occupation by the Japanese?
At a distance, mm. Because on a Sunday morning they used to have some hangings, war criminals.
Really?
In Changi Jail. And you're supposed to go down and witness it by rota, you know, but a clam managed to get out of that job. We had some Japs, there were still Japanese soldiery in POW camps, mm. and we used to go and draw half a dozen or a dozen or what have you in the morning for labour, you know, to go and do jobs. Mm. And I brought back a Jap sword from there, which, strangely enough, I thought, well, nobody's interested in this any longer, so I sold it the other day for £250.
So, a lot of anti-Japanese feeling there.
Yes, I think there was. More so in Rangoon.
Mm, really?
Oh, yes. Mm. Yes, but you see, we didn't have any contact with the local people at all. Mm. But I know in Rangoon, the story, I mean, if the Japs wanted 10,000 3/8 bolts, they'd issue out that thing, and all the local burglars would go around the town looking for these 3/8 bolts, whatever was required, and sell them to the Japanese. That was the way they got their bits and pieces.
Oh, really? So Singapore was obviously quite a pleasant sort of...
Oh, that's lovely, yeah. Yes. The Raffles Hotel was the original Raffles Hotel, still with the bamboo seats. Mm. Yeah, so it was very nice there. Mind you, I say I had about 3 or 4 months holiday there, which was very nice, really. I didn't do much work.
No. So, yeah, I mean, you'd been away for all this time from your wife, who you'd married. Yeah. When was it?
We married in 43.
Right.
I got home in July 47. But I did see a bit in England before we went.
Yes,
but
yeah,
but
yeah.
Long time.
Mm, mm. Did you feel resentful about that?
Well, in a way, yes. Mm. And of course, the thing which, in retrospect, I'm more resentful about is we missed out on life that the young people have today. We never had any of that sort of thing. We were straight from school, virtually, into the army. Mm. And then immediately after, by the time it got demobbed, you know, life was pretty grim in this country. And by the time we'd all got married or whatever, and we were adults and responsibilities, and we missed out. And of course, if it hadn't been a war, you wouldn't have been married at that age.
Bob's